Chapter 20. Hang Women for the Hangman of Berlin. I found out only recently, in 1958 or 1959, how my father-in-law died. I knew he was dead. The detective agency I had hired to find word of Helga had told me that much, that Werner Nolt was dead. The details of his death came to hand by chance, in a Greenwich Village barber shop. I was leafing through a girly magazine, admiring the way women were made, and awaiting my turn for a haircut. The story advertised on the magazine cover was, "Hang Women for the Hangman of Berlin." There was no reason for me to suppose that the article was about my father-in-law. Hanging hadn't been his business. I turned to the article. And I looked for quite a while at a murky photograph of Werner Nolt being hanged from an apple tree without suspecting who the hanged man was. I looked at the faces of the people at the hanging. They were mostly women. Nameless, shapeless ragbags. And I played a game, counting the ways in which the magazine cover had lied. For one thing, the women weren't doing the hanging. Three scrawny men in rags were doing it. For another thing, the women in the photograph weren't beautiful, and the hang women on the cover were. The hang women on the cover had breasts like cantaloupes, hips like horse collars, and their rags were the pathetic remains of nightgowns by Schiaparelli. The women in the photograph were as pretty as catfish, wrapped in mattress ticking. And then, just before I began to read the story of the hanging, I began, tentatively and queasily, to recognize the shattered building in the background. Behind the hangman, looking like a mouthful of broken teeth, was all that was left of the home of Werner Nolt, of the home where my Helga had been raised as a good German citizen, of the home where I had said farewell to a 10-year-old nihilist named Resi. I read the text. The text was by a man named Ian Westlake, and it was very well done. Westlake, an Englishman, a liberated prisoner of war, had seen the hanging shortly after his liberation by the Russians. The photographs were his. Nolt, he said, had been hanged from his own apple tree by slave laborers, mostly Poles and Russians, quartered nearby. Westlake did not call my father-in-law the hangman of Berlin. Westlake went to some trouble to find out what crimes Nolt had committed, and he concluded that Nolt had been no better and no worse than any other big city chief of police. Terror and torture were the provinces of other branches of the German police, said Westlake. Werner Nolt's own province was what is regarded in every big city as ordinary law and order. The force he directed was the sworn enemy of drunks, thieves, murderers, rapists, looters, confidence men, prostitutes, and other disturbers of the peace, and it did its best to keep the city traffic moving. Nolt's principal offense, said Westlake, was that he introduced persons of suspected misdemeanors and crimes into a system of courts and penal institutions that was insane. Nolt did his best to distinguish between the guilty and the innocent, using the most modern police methods. But those to whom he handed over his prisoners found the distinction of no importance. Merely to be in custody, with or without trial, was a crime. Prisoners of every sort were all to be humiliated, exhausted, and killed. Westlake went on to say that the slave laborers who hanged Nolt had no clear idea who he was, beyond the fact that he was somebody important. They hanged him for the satisfaction of hanging somebody important. Nolt's house, said Westlake, had been demolished by Russian artillery, but Nolt had continued to live in one undamaged room in the back. Westlake took an inventory of the room, found it to contain a bed, a table, and a candlestick. On the table were framed photographs of Helga, Resi, and Nolt's wife. There was a book. It was a German translation of the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Why such a miserable magazine had bought such a fine piece of reporting was not explained. What the magazine was sure its readers would like was the description of the hanging itself. My father-in-law was stood on a footstool 4 inches high. The rope was put around his neck and drawn tight over the limb of a budding apple tree. The footstool was then kicked out from under him. He could dance on the ground while he strangled. Good? He was revived 8 times and hanged 9. Only after the 8th hanging were his last bits of courage and dignity gone. Only after the 8th hanging did he act like a child being tortured. For that performance, said Westlake, he was rewarded with what he wanted most in all this world. He was rewarded with death. He died with an erection, and his feet were bare. I turned the page of the magazine to see if there was more. There was more, but not more of the same. There was a full-page photograph of a pretty woman with her thighs spread wide and her tongue stuck out. The barber called out to me. He shook another man's hair out of the cloth he was going to put around my neck. Next, he said. Chapter 21. My Best Friend. I said that I'd stolen the motorcycle I rode when I called on Werner Note for the last time. I should explain. I didn't really steal it. I just borrowed it, for all eternity, from Heinz Schildknecht, my ping-pong doubles partner, my closest friend in Germany. We used to drink together, used to talk long into the night, especially after we both lost our wives. I feel I can tell you anything. Absolutely anything, he said to me one night, late in the war. I feel the same way about you, Heinz, I said. Anything I have is yours, he said. Anything I have is yours, Heinz, I said. The amount of property between us was negligible. Neither one of us had a home. Our real estate and our furniture were blown to smithereens. I had a watch, a typewriter, and a bicycle, and that was about it. Heinz had long since traded his watch and his typewriter and even his wedding ring for black market cigarettes. All he had left in this vale of tears, excepting my friendship and the clothes on his back, was a motorcycle. If anything ever happens to the motorcycle, he said to me, I am a pauper. He looked around for eavesdroppers. I will tell you something terrible, he said. Don't if you don't want to, I said. I want to, he said. You are the person I can tell terrible things to. I'm going to tell you something simply awful. The place where we were drinking and talking was a pillbox near the dormitory where we both slept. It had been built very recently for the defense of Berlin, had been built by slaves. It wasn't armed, wasn't manned. The Russians weren't that close yet. Heinz and I sat there with a bottle and a candle between us, and he told me the terrible thing. He was drunk. Howard, he said, I love my motorcycle more than I loved my wife. I want to be a friend of yours, and I want to believe everything you say, Heinz, I said to him, but I refuse to believe that. Let's just forget you said it, because it isn't true. No, he said. This is one of those moments when somebody really speaks the truth. One of those rare moments. People hardly ever speak the truth, but now I am speaking the truth. If you are the friend I think you are, you'll do me the honor of believing the friend I think I am when I speak the truth. All right, I said. There were tears streaming down his cheeks. I sold her jewelry, her favorite furniture, even her meat ration one time, all for cigarettes for me, he said. We've all done things we're ashamed of, I said. I would not quit smoking for her sake, said Heinz. We all have bad habits, I said. When the bomb hit the apartment, killed her and left me with nothing but a motorcycle, he said. The black market man offered me 4,000 cigarettes for the motorcycle. I know, I said. He told me the same story every time he got drunk. and I gave up smoking at once, he said, because I loved the motorcycle so. We all cling to something, I said. To the wrong things, he said, and we start clinging too late. I will tell you the one thing I really believe out of all the things there are to believe. All right, I said. All people are insane, he said. They will do anything at any time, and God help anybody who looks for reasons. As for the kind of woman Heinz's wife had been, I knew her only slightly, though I saw her fairly often. She was a non-stop talker, which made her hard to know, and her theme was always the same. Successful people who saw opportunities and grasped them firmly. People who, unlike her husband, were important and rich.
Young Kurt Ehrens, she would say. Only 26 and a full colonel in the SS. And his brother, Heinrich. He can't be more than 34, but he has 18,000 foreign workers under him, all building tank traps. Heinrich knows more about tank traps than any man alive, they say, and I used to dance with him.
On and on she would talk this way, with poor Heinz in the background, smoking his brains out. And one thing she did to me was made me deaf to all success stories. The people she saw as succeeding in a brave new world were, after all, being rewarded as specialists in slavery, destruction, and death. I don't consider people who work in those fields successful. As the war drew to a close, Heinz and I couldn't drink in our pillbox anymore. An 88 was set up in it, and the gun was manned by boys about 15 or 16 years old. There was a success story for Heinz's late wife. Boys that young, and yet with men's uniforms, and a fully armed death trap all their own. So Heinz and I did our drinking and talking in our dormitory. A riding hall jammed with bombed-out government workers sleeping on straw mattresses. We kept our bottle hidden, since we did not care to share it. Heinz, I said to him one night, I wonder how good a friend you really are. He was stung. Why should you ask me that? He said. I want to ask a favor of you, a very big one, and I don't know if I should, I said. I demand that you ask it, he said. Lend me your motorcycle, so I can visit my in-laws tomorrow, I said. He did not hesitate, did not quail. Take it, he said. So the next morning I did. We started out the next morning side by side, Heinz on my bicycle, me on his motorcycle. I kicked the starter, put the motorcycle in gear, and off I went, leaving my best friend smiling in a cloud of blue exhaust. Off I went, vroom, kapow, kapow, vroom. And he never saw his motorcycle or his best friend again. I have asked the Haifa Institute for the Documentation of War Criminals if they have any news of Heinz, though he wasn't much of a war criminal. The Institute delights me with the news that Heinz is now in Ireland, is chief groundskeeper for Baron Ulrich Werther von Schwefelbad. Von Schwefelbad bought a big estate in Ireland after the war. The Institute tells me that Heinz is an expert on the death of Hitler, having stumbled into Hitler's bunker while Hitler's gasoline-soaked body was burning, but still recognizable. Hello out there, Heinz, in case you read this. I was really very fond of you, to the extent that I am capable of being fond of anybody. Give the Blarney Stone a kiss for me. What were you doing in Hitler's bunker? Looking for your motorcycle? And your best friend? Chapter 22. The Contents of an Old Trunk. Look, I said to my Helga in Greenwich Village, after I had told her what little I knew about her mother, father, and sister. This attic will never do for a love nest. Not even for one night. We'll get a taxi. We'll go to some hotel. And tomorrow we'll throw out all this furniture, get everything brand new. And then we'll look for a really nice place to live. I'm very happy here, she said. Tomorrow, I said, we'll find a bed like our old bed, 2 miles long and 3 miles wide, with a headboard like an Italian sunset. Remember, oh Lord, remember? Yes, she said. Tonight in a hotel, I said. Tomorrow night in a bed like that.
We leave right now? She said.
Whatever you say, I said.
Can I show you my presents first? She said. Presents, I said.
For you, she said. You're my present, I said. What more would I want?
You might want these too, she said,
freeing the catches on a suitcase.
I hope you do.
She opened the suitcase, showed me that it was full of manuscripts. Her present to me was my collected works, my collected serious works, almost every heartfelt word ever written by me, the late Howard W. Campbell, Jr. There were poems, stories, plays, letters, one unpublished book, the collected works of myself as a buoyant, free, and young, young man.
How queer this makes me feel, I said. I shouldn't have brought them, she said.
I hardly know, I said. These pieces of paper were me at one time. I picked up the book manuscript, a bizarre experiment called Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova. This you should have burned, I said.
I would just as gladly burn my own right arm, she said.
I put the book aside, took up a sheaf of poems. What does this young stranger have to say about life? I said. And I read a poem in German, aloud.
Kühl und hell der Sonnenaufgang, leis und süß der Glocke klang, ein Magdlein hold Krug in der Hand, sitzt an des tiefen Brunnesrand.
In English, roughly, cool bright sunrise, faint sweet bell, maiden with a pitcher, by a cool deep well. I read that poem out loud, and then I read another. I wasn't am a very bad poet. I do not set down these poems to be admired. The second poem I read was, I think, the next to last poem I ever wrote. It was dated 1937, and it had this title.
Gedanken über unseren Abstand vom Zeitgeschehen.
Or roughly, Reflections on Not Participating in Current Events. It went like this.
Eine mächtige dampfhafte Nacht und schwarz der Sonnenpfad holt übergedückte Menschen dahin, will keine Jahr entfliehen. Mein Lieb und ich schon starren Blickes, das Rätsel dieser Blutgeschickes. Kommt mit herab, die Menschheit schreit, die Walze ist die Geschickte der Zeit. Mein Lieb und ich gehen auf die Flut, wo keine Dampfwalze uns sucht. Und leben auf den Birkesühlen, getrennt von schwarzen Zeitgeschehen. Sollen wir bleiben mit den anderen zu sterben? Doch nein, wir zwei wollen nicht verderben. Nun ist vorbei, wir zählen mit der Bleichen. Die Opfer du Wolze, verfolgte Leichen.
In English? I saw a huge steamroller. It blotted out the sun. The people all lay down, lay down. They did not try to run. My love and I, we looked amazed upon the gory mystery. Lie down, the people cried. The great machine is history. My love and I, we ran away. The engine did not find us. We ran up to a mountaintop, left history far behind us. Perhaps we should have stayed and died, but somehow we don't think so. We went to see where history'd been. And my, the dead did stink so. How is it, I said to Helga, that you have all these things?
When I went to West Berlin, she said, I went to the theater to see if there was a theater left, if there was anyone I knew left, if anyone had any news of you.
She didn't have to explain which theater she meant. She meant the little theater, where my plays had been produced in Berlin, where Helga had been the star so often. It got through most of the war, I know, I said. It still exists?
Yes, she said. And when I asked about you, they knew nothing. And when I told them what you had once meant to that theater, someone remembered that there was a trunk in the loft with your name on it. I passed my hand over the manuscripts. And in it were these, I said. I remember the trunk now. Remember when I'd closed it up at the start of the war. Remembered when I'd thought of the trunk as a coffin for the young man I would never be again. You already have copies of these things? She said. No, I said. Not a scrap. You don't write anymore? She said. There hasn't been anything I've wanted to say, I said. After all you've seen, all you've been through, darling, she said. It's all I've seen, all I've been through, I said. That makes it damn nearly impossible for me to say anything. I've lost the knack of making sense. I speak gibberish to the civilized world, and it replies in kind. There was another poem, your last poem it must have been, she said, written in eyebrow pencil on the inside of the trunk lid. Oh, I said. She recited it for me. Hier liegt Howard Campbells Geist geborgen, frei von des Körpers quellenden Sorgen. Sein leerer Leib, der streift die Welt und kargen Lohn dafür erhält. Triffst du die beiden getrennt allerwärts? Wer brennt den Leib, doch schiene dies sein Herz. In English? Here lies Howard Campbell's essence, freed from his body's noisome nuisance. His body, empty, prowls the earth, earning what a body's worth. If his body and his essence remain apart, burn his body, but spare this, his heart. There was a knock on the door. It was George Kraft knocking on my door, and I let him in. He was very jangled, because his corncob pipe had disappeared. It was the first time I'd seen him without the pipe, the first time he showed me how dependent he was on the pipe for peace. He was so full of anxiety that he whined. Somebody took it. Or somebody knocked it down behind something, or... I just can't imagine why anybody would have done anything with it. He whined. He expected Helga and me to share his anxiety, to think that the disappearance of the pipe was the most important event of the day. He was insufferable. Why would anyone want to touch the pipe? He said. What good would it do anybody? He was opening and shutting his hands, blinking often, sniffling, acting like a dope addict with withdrawal symptoms, though he had never smoked anything in the missing pipe. Just tell me, he said. Why would anybody take the pipe? I don't know, George, I said testily. If we find it, we'll let you know. Could I look around for myself? He said. Go ahead, I said. And he turned the place upside down, rattling pots and pans, banging cupboard doors, fishing back of the radiators with a poker, clangingly. The effect of this performance on Helga and me was to wed us, to urge us into an easy relationship that might otherwise have been a long while coming. We stood side by side, resenting the invasion of our nation of two. It wasn't the very valuable pipe, was it? I said. Yes, it was. To me, he said. Buy another one, I said. I want that one, he said. I'm used to it. That's the pipe I want. He opened the bread box, looked inside. Maybe the ambulance attendants took it, I said. Why would they do that, he said. Maybe they thought it belonged to the dead man, I said. Maybe they put it in the dead man's pocket. That's it, cried Kraft, and he scuttled out the door. Chapter 23. Chapter 643. One of the things Helga had in her suitcase, as I've already said, was a book by me. It was a manuscript. I had never intended that it be published. I regarded it as unpublishable, except by pornographers. It was called Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova.
In it, I told of my conquests, of all the hundreds of women my wife, my Helga, had been. It was clinical, obsessed, some say insane. It was a diary, recording day by day, for the first 2 years of the war, our erotic life, to the exclusion of all else. There is not one word in it to indicate even the century or the continent of its origin. There is a man of many moods, a woman of many moods. In some of the early entries, settings are referred to sketchily. But from then on, there are no settings at all. Helga knew I kept the peculiar diary. I kept it as one of many devices for keeping our sexual pleasure keen. The book is not only a report of an experiment, but a part of the experiment it reports. A self-conscious experiment by a man and a woman to be endlessly fascinating to each other sexually. To be more than that. To be to each other, body and soul, sufficient reasons for living, though there might not be a single other satisfaction to be had. The epigraph of the book is to the point, I think. It is a poem by William Blake called The Question Answered. What is it men in women do require? The lineaments of gratified desire. What is it women do in men require? The lineaments of gratified desire. I might aptly add here one last chapter to the memoirs, chapter 643, describing the night I spent in a New York hotel with Helga, after having been without her for so many years. I leave it to an editor of taste and delicacy to abridge with innocent polka dots whatever might offend. Memoirs of a Monogamous Casanova, chapter 643. We had been apart for 16 years. My first lust that night was in my fingertips, other parts of me, that were contended later, were contended in a ritual way, thoroughly, to clinical perfection. No part of me could complain, and no part of my wife could complain, I trust, of being victimized by busy work, time-serving, or jerry-building. But my fingertips had the best of it that night. Which is not to say that I found myself to be an old man, dependent, if I was to please a woman, on foreplay and nothing more. On the contrary, I was as ready a lover as a 17-year-old with his girl, and as full of wonder. And it was in my fingers that the wonder lived. Calm, resourceful, thoughtful, these explorers, these strategists, these scouts, these skirmishers, deployed themselves over the terrain. And all the news they gathered was good. My wife was a slave girl, bedded with an emperor that night, seemingly struck dumb, seemingly not even able to speak a word of my language. And yet, how eloquent she was, letting her eyes, her breathing, express what they must, unable to keep them from expressing what they must. And how simple, how sublimely familiar was the tale her body told. It was like the breeze's tale of what a breeze is, like the rose's tale of what the rose is. After my subtle, thoughtful and grateful fingers came greedier things, instruments of pleasure without memories, without manners, without patience. These my slave girl met in greedy kind, until Mother Nature herself, who had made the most extravagant demands upon us, could ask no more. Mother Nature herself called an end to the game. We rolled apart. We spoke coherently to each other for the first time since bedding down. Hello, she said. Hello, I said. Welcome home, she said. End of chapter 643. The city sky was clean and hard and bright the next morning. looking like an enchanted dome that would shatter at a tap or ring like a great glass bell. My Helga and I stepped from our hotel to the sidewalk snappily. I was lavish in my courtliness, and my Helga was no less grand in her respect and gratitude. We had had a marvelous night. I was not wearing war surplus clothing. I was wearing the clothes I had put on after fleeing Berlin, after shucking off the uniform of the Free American Corps. I was wearing the clothes, fur-collared impresario's cloak and blue serge suit, I had been captured in. I was also carrying, for whimsy, a cane. I did marvelous things with the cane. Rococo manuals of arms, Charlie Chaplin twirls, polo strokes at orts in the gutter. And all the while my Helga's small hand rested on my good left arm, creeping in an endless and erotic exploration of the tingling area between the inside of my elbow and the crest of my stringy biceps. We were on our way to buy a bed like our bed in Berlin. But all the stores were closed. The day wasn't Sunday. It wasn't any holiday I could think of. When we got to Fifth Avenue, there were American flags flying as far as the eye could see. "Good God Almighty," I said wonderingly. "What does it mean?" said Helga. "Maybe they declared war last night," I said. She tightened her fingers on my arm convulsively. "You don't really think so, do you?" she said. She thought it was possible. "A joke," I said. "Some kind of holiday, obviously." "What holiday?" she said. I was still drawing blanks. "As your host in this wonderful land of ours," I said, "I should explain to you the deep significance of this great day in our national lives, but nothing comes to me." "Nothing?" she said. "I'm as baffled as you are," I said. "I might as well be the Prince of Cambodia." A uniformed colored man was sweeping the walk in front of an apartment. His blue and gold uniform bore a striking resemblance to the uniform of the Free American Corps, even to the final touch of a pale lavender stripe down his trouser legs. The name of the apartment house was stitched over his breast pocket. Sylvan House was the name of the place, though the only tree near it was a sapling, bandaged, armored, and guy-wired. I asked the man what day it was. He told me it was Veterans Day. "What date is that?" I said.
"November 11th, sir," he said.
"November 11th is Armistice Day, not Veterans Day," I said.
"Where you been?" he said. "They changed all that years ago."
"Veterans Day," I said to Helga as we walked on.
"Used to be Armistice Day, now it's Veterans Day."
"That upsets you?" she said. "Oh, it's just so damn cheap, so damn typical," I said. "This used to be a day in honor of the dead of World War I. But the living couldn't keep their grubby hands off of it, wanted the glory of the dead for themselves. So typical, so typical. Anytime anything of real dignity appears in this country, it's torn to shreds and thrown to the mob." "You hate America, don't you?" she said. "That would be as silly as loving it," I said. "It's impossible for me to get emotional about it, because real estate doesn't interest me. It's no doubt a great flaw in my personality, but I can't think in terms of boundaries. Those imaginary lines are as unreal to me as elves and pixies. I can't believe that they mark the end or the beginning of anything of real concern to a human soul. Virtues and vices, pleasures and pains cross boundaries at will."
"You've changed so," she said.
"People should be changed by world wars," I said. "Else what are world wars for?"
"Maybe you've changed so much, you don't really love me anymore," she said. "Maybe I've changed so much."
"After a night like last night," I said, "how could you say such a thing?"
"We really haven't talked anything over," she said.
"What is there to talk about?" I said.
"Nothing you could say would make me love you more or less. Our love is too deep for words ever to touch it. It's soul love.
she sighed. How lovely that is, if it's true. She put her hands close together, but not touching. Our souls in love. A love that can weather anything, I said. Your soul feels love now for my soul, she said. Obviously, I said. And you couldn't be deceived by that feeling, she said. You couldn't be mistaken. Not a chance, I said. And nothing I could say could spoil it, she said. Nothing, I said. All right, she said. I have something to say that I was afraid to say before. I'm not afraid to say it now. Say away, I said lightly. I'm not Helga, she said. I'm her little sister, Racy. Chapter 24. A Polygamous Casanova. After she gave me the news, I took her into a nearby cafeteria so we could sit down. The ceiling was high, the lights were merciless, the clatter was hell. Why did you do this to me? I said. Because I love you, she said. How could you love me? I said. I've always loved you, since I was a very little girl, she said. I put my head in my hands. This is terrible, I said. I thought it was beautiful, she said. What now, I said. It can't go on, she said. Oh, Jesus, how bewildering, I said. I found the words to kill the love, didn't I, she said. The love that couldn't be killed. I don't know, I said. I shook my head. What is this strange crime I've committed? I'm the one who's committed the crime, she said. I must have been crazy. Then I escaped into West Berlin. Then they gave me a form to fill out. Asked me who I was, what I was, who I knew. That long, long story you told, I said, about Russia. About Dresden, was any of it true? The cigarette factory in Dresden. That was true, she said. My running away to Berlin was true. Not much else. The cigarette factory, she said. That was the truest thing. 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, 10 years. Sorry, I said. I'm the one who's sorry, she said. Life's been too hard for me ever to afford much guilt. A really bad conscience is as much out of my reach as a mink coat. Daydreams were what kept me going at the machine, day after day, and I had no right to them. Why not, I said. They were all daydreams of being somebody I wasn't. No harm in that, I said. Look at the harm, she said. Look at you. Look at me. Look at our love affair. I daydreamed of being my sister Helga. Helga, 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 that's who I was. The lovely actress with the handsome playwright husband, that's who I was. Razy, the cigarette machine operator, she simply disappeared. You could have picked a worse person to be, I said. She became very brave now. It's who I am, she said. It's who I am. I'm Helga, Helga, Helga. You believed it. What better test could I be put to? Have I been Helga to you? That's a hell of a question to put to a gentleman, I said. Am I entitled to an answer? She said. You're entitled to the answer, yes, I said. I have to answer yes. But I have to say I'm not a well man either. My judgment, my senses, my intuition obviously aren't all they could be. Or maybe they are all they should be, she said. Maybe you haven't been deceived. Tell me what you know about Helga, I said. Dead, she said. You're sure, I said. Isn't she, she said. I don't know, I said. I haven't heard of her, she said. Have you? No, I said. Living people make words, don't they? She said.
especially if they love someone as much as Helga loved you.
You'd think so, I said.
I love you as much as Helga did, she said.
Thank you, I said.
And did you hear from me? She said. It took some doing, but you did hear from me.
Indeed, I said.
Then I got to West Berlin, she said, and they gave me the forms to fill out. Name, occupation, nearest living relative. I had my choice. I could be raising note, cigarette machine operator, with no relatives anywhere. Or I could be Helga Note, actress, wife of a handsome, adorable, brilliant playwright in the USA.
She leaned forward.
You tell me, she said. Which one should I have been?
God forgive me. I accepted Raisi as my Helga again.
Once she got that second acceptance, though, she began to show in little ways that her identification with Helga wasn't as complete as she'd said. She felt free, bit by bit, to accustom me to a personality that wasn't Helga's but her own. This gradual revelation, this weaning of me from memories of Helga, began as we left the cafeteria. She asked me a jarringly practical question.
Do you want me to keep on bleaching my hair white? She said. Or can I let it come back the way it really is?
What is it really? I said.
Honey, she said.
A lovely color for hair, I said.
Helga's color.
Mine has more red in it, she said. I'd be interested to see it, I said. We walked up Fifth Avenue, and a little later she said to me,
Will you write a play for me sometime?
I don't know if I can write anymore, I said.
Didn't Helga inspire you to write, she said.
Not to write, but to write the way I wrote, I said.
You wrote a special way, so she could play the part, she said.
That's right, I said. I wrote parts for Helga that let her be the quintessence of Helga on stage.
I want you to do that for me sometime, she said.
Maybe I'll try, I said.
The quintessence of Raisi, she said. Raisi Note.
We saw a Veterans Day parade down Fifth Avenue, and I heard Raisi's laugh for the first time. It was nothing like Helga's laugh, which was a rustling thing. Raisi's laugh was bright, melodious. What struck her so funny was the drum majorettes, kicking at the moon, twitching their behinds, and twirling chromium dildos.
I've never seen such a thing before, she said to me. War must be a very sexy thing to Americans.
She went on laughing, and she thrust out her bosom to see if she might not make a good drum majorette too. She was growing younger by the second, gayer, more raucously irreverent. Her white hair, which had made me think so recently of premature aging, now updated itself, spoke of peroxide and girls who ran away to Hollywood. When we turned away from the parade, we looked into a store window that showed a great gilded bed, one very much like the one Helga and I once had. And not only did the window show that Wagnerian bed, it showed a reflection of Raisi and me, too, ghost-like, and with a ghostly parade behind us. The pale wraiths and the substantial bed formed an unsettling composition. It seemed to be an allegory in the Victorian manner. A pretty good barroom painting, actually, with the passing banners and the golden bed and the male and female ghosts. What the allegory was, I cannot say. But I can offer a few more clues. The male ghost looked god-awful old and starved and moth-eaten. The female ghost looked young enough to be his daughter, sleek, bouncy, and full of hell. Chapter 25. The Answer to Communism. Raisi and I dawdled on our way back to my ratty attic, looked at furniture, drank here and there. Raisi went to the ladies' room in one bar, leaving me alone. A barfly started talking to me.
You know what the answer to communism is? He asked me.
Nope, I said.
Moral rearmament, he said.
What the hell is that? I said.
It's a movement, he said.
In what direction? I said.
That moral rearmament movement, he said. Believes in absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love.
I certainly wish them all the luck in the world, I said. In another bar, Raisi and I met a man who claimed he could satisfy, thoroughly satisfy, 7 women in a night, provided they were all different.
I mean really different, he said.
Oh, God, the lives people try to lead. Oh, God, what a world they try to lead them in. Chapter 26, in which Private Irving Buchanan and some others are memorialized. Raisi and I didn't get home until after supper, after dark. Our plan was to spend another night at a hotel. We came home because Raisi wanted to have a waking dream of how we would refurnish the attic, wanted to play house. At last I have a house, she said.
It takes a heap of living, I said, to make a house a home.
I saw that my mailbox was stuffed again. I left the mail where it was.
Who did that? Said Raisi.
Who did what? I said.
That,
she said, pointing to my name card on the mailbox. Somebody had drawn a swastika after my name in blue ink. It's something quite new, I said uneasily. Maybe we'd better not go upstairs. Maybe whoever did it is up there.
I don't understand, she said.
You picked a miserable time to come to me, Raisi, I said. I had a cozy little burrow, where you and I might have been quite content.
Burrow? She said.
A hole in the ground, made secret and snug, I said.
But God,
I said in anguish. Just when you were coming to me, something laid my den wide open. I told her how my notoriety had been renewed. Now the carnivores, I said, scenting a freshly opened den, are closing in.
Go to another country, she said.
What other country, I said.
Any country you like, she said. You have the money to go anywhere you want.
Anywhere I want, I said. And then a bald, bristly fat man, carrying a shopping bag, came in. He shouldered Raisi and me away from the mailboxes with a hoarse, unapologetic bully's apology.
Excuse me,
he said. He read the names on the mailboxes like a first grader, putting a finger under each name, studying each name for a long, long time.
Campbell, he said at last, with massive satisfaction. Howard W. Campbell.
He turned to me accusingly.
You know him?
He said.
No, I said. No, he said,
becoming radiant with malevolence.
You look just like him.
He took a copy of the Daily News from the shopping bag, opened it to an inside page, handed it to Raisi.
Now don't that look a lot like the gentleman you're with?
He said to her.
Let me see, I said.
I took the paper from Raisi's slack fingers, saw the picture of myself and Lieutenant O'Hare standing before the gallows at Ordruth, so long ago. The story underneath the picture said that the government of Israel had located me after a 15-year search. That government was now requesting that the United States release me to Israel for trial. What did they want to try me for? Complicity in the murder of 6 million Jews. The man hit me right through the newspaper before I could comment. Down I went, banging my head on an ash can. The man stood over me.
Before the Jews put you in a cage in a zoo or whatever they're gonna do to you, he said, I'd just like to play a little with you myself.
I shook my head, trying to clear it.
Felt that one, did you? He said.
Yes, I said. That one was for Private Irving Buchanan, he said. Is that who you are? I said. Buchanan is dead, he said. He was the best friend I ever had. 5 miles from Omaha Beach, the Germans cut his nuts off and hung him from a telephone pole. He kicked me in the ribs, holding Rezzy off with one hand. That's for Ansel Brewer, he said. Run over by a tiger tank at Aachen. He kicked me again. That's for Eddie McCarty, cut in two by a burp gun in the Ardennes, he said. Eddie was going to be a doctor. He drew back his big foot to kick me in the head. And this one, he said. And that's the last I heard. The kick was for somebody else who'd been killed in war. It knocked me cold. Razy told me later what the last things the man said were, and what the present for me was in the shopping bag. I'm the guy who hasn't forgot that war, he said to me, though I could not hear him. Everybody else has forgot it, as near as I can tell, but not me. I brought you this, he said, so you could save everybody a lot of trouble. And he left. Razy put the noose in the ash can, where it was found the next morning by a garbage man named Laszlo Zombathy. Zombathy actually hanged himself with it, but that is another story. As for my own story, I regained consciousness on a ruptured studio couch in a damp, overheated room that was hung with mildewed Nazi banners. There was a cardboard fireplace, a dime store's idea of how to have a Merry Christmas. In it were cardboard birch logs, a red electric light, and cellophane tongues of eternal fire. Over this fireplace was a chromo of Adolf Hitler. It was swathed in black silk. I myself was stripped to my olive drab underwear, covered with a bedspread of simulated leopard skin. I groaned and sat up, skyrockets going off in my skull. I looked down at the leopard skin and mumbled something. What did you say, darling? Said Racy. She was sitting right beside the cot, though I hadn't seen her until she spoke. Don't tell me, I said, drawing the leopard skin closer about me. I've joined the Hottentots. Chapter 27 Finders Keepers. My research assistants here, lively, keen young people, have provided me with a photostat of a story in the New York Times telling of the death of Laszlo Zombathy, the man who killed himself with the rope intended for me. So I didn't dream that either. Zombathy did the big trick the night after I was beaten up. He had come to this country after being a freedom fighter against the Russians in Hungary, according to the Times. He was a fratricide, according to the Times, having shot his brother Miklos, second minister of education in Hungary. Before he gave himself the big sleep, Zombathy wrote a note and pinned it to his trouser leg. There was nothing in the note about his having killed his brother. His complaint was that he had been a respected veterinarian in Hungary, but that he was not permitted to practice in America. He had bitter things to say about freedom in America. He thought it was illusory. In a final fandango of paranoia and masochism, Zombathy closed his note with a hint that he knew how to cure cancer. American doctors laughed at him, he said, whenever he tried to tell them how. So much for Zombathy. As for the room where I awakened after my beating, it was the cellar that had been furnished for the Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution by the late August Kaptauer, the cellar of Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD. Somewhere upstairs, a printing press was running, turning out copies of the White Christian Minuteman. From some other chamber in the cellar, partly soundproofed, came the idiotically monotonous banging of target practice. After my beating, I had been given first aid by young Dr. Abraham Epstein, the doctor in my building, who had pronounced Koptower dead. From Epstein's apartment, Raisi had called Dr. Jones for help and advice.
"Why Jones?" I said.
"He was the only person in this country I knew I could trust," said Raisi. "He was the only person I knew for sure was on your side."
"What is life without friends?" I said. I have no recollection of it, but Raisi tells me that I regained consciousness in Epstein's apartment. Jones picked Raisi and me up in his limousine, took me to a hospital where I was x-rayed. I had 3 broken ribs taped up. After that, I was taken to Jones's cellar and bedded down.
"Why here?" I said.
"It's safe," said Raisi.
"From what?" I said.
"The Jews," she said.
The Black Führer of Harlem, Jones's chauffeur, now came in with a tray of eggs, toast, and scalding coffee. He set it down on a table for me.
"Headache?"
he asked me.
"Yes," I said.
"Take a aspirin," he said.
"Thank you for the advice," I said.
"Most things in this world don't work," he said, "but aspirin do."
The Republic of Israel really wants me? I said to Raisi in groping disbelief.
To try me for what the papers said?
"Dr. Jones says the American government won't let you go," said Raisi, "but that the Jews will send men to kidnap you. The way they did Adolf Eichmann."
"Such a piffling prisoner," I murmured.
"Ain't like just having a Jew here and a Jew there after you," said the Black Führer.
"What?" I said.
"I mean," he said, "they got a country now. I mean, they got Jewish battleships, they got Jewish airplanes, they got Jewish tanks, they got Jewish everything out after you but a Jewish hydrogen bomb."
"Who in God's name is doing that shooting?" I said. "Can't he stop until my head feels a little better?"
"That's your friend," said Raisi.
"Dr. Jones," I said.
"George Kraft," she said.
"Kraft," I said. "What's he doing here?"
"He's coming with us," said Raisi.
"To where?" I said.
"It's all been decided," said Raisi. "Everybody agrees, darling. The best thing is for us to get out of the country. Dr. Jones has made arrangements."
"What sort of arrangements?" I said.
"He has a friend with an airplane. As soon as you're well enough, darling, we get on the plane, fly to some divine place where you aren't known, and we'll start life all over again."
Chapter 28. Target. I went to see George Kraft, there in Jones's basement. I found him standing at the head of a long corridor, the far end of which was packed with sandbags. Pinned to the sandbags was a target in the shape of a man. The target was a caricature of a cigar-smoking Jew. The Jew was standing on broken crosses and little naked women. In one hand, the Jew held a bag of money labeled International Banking. In the other hand, he held a Russian flag. From the pockets of his suit, little fathers, mothers, and children in scale with the naked women under his feet cried out for mercy. All these details were not evident from the far end of the shooting gallery, but it wasn't necessary for me to approach the target in order to know about them. I had drawn the target in about 1941. Millions of copies of the target were run off in Germany. It had so delighted my superiors that I was given a bonus of a 10-pound ham, 30 gallons of gasoline, and a week's all-expenses-paid vacation for my wife and myself at the Schreiberhaus in Riesengebirge. I must admit that this target represents an excess of zeal, since I was not working as a graphic artist for the Nazis. I offer it in evidence against myself. I presume my authorship of it is news even to the Haifa Institute for the Documentation of War Criminals. I submit, however, that I drew the monster in order to establish myself even more solidly as a Nazi. I overdrew it, with an effect that would have been ludicrous anywhere but in Germany or Jones's basement. And I drew it far more amateurishly than I can really draw. It succeeded nonetheless. I was flabbergasted by its success. The Hitler Youth and SS recruits fired at almost nothing else. And I even got a letter of thanks for the targets from Heinrich Himmler. "It has improved my marksmanship 100%, he wrote. What pure Aryan can look at that wonderful target, he said, and not shoot to kill? Watching Kraft pop away at that target, I understood its popularity for the first time. The amateurishness of it made it look like something drawn on the wall of a public lavatory. It recalled the stink, diseased twilight, humid resonance, and vile privacy of a stall in a public lavatory. Echoed exactly the soul's condition in a man at war. I had drawn better than I knew. Kraft, oblivious to me in my leopard skin, fired again. He was using a Luger as big as a siege howitzer. It was chambered and bored for mere 22s, however, making anticlimactic peewee bangs. Kraft fired again, and a sandbag 2 feet to the left of the target's head bled sand. "Try opening your eyes the next time you fire," I said.
"Oh," he said, putting the pistol down. "You're up and around."
"Yes," I said.
"Too bad what happened," he said.
"I thought so," I said.
"Maybe it's for the best, though," he said. "Maybe we'll all wind up thanking God it happened."
"How so?" I said.
"It's jarred us out of our ruts," he said.
"That's for certain," I said.
"When you get out of this country with your girl, get yourself new surroundings, a new identity, you'll start writing again," he said. "And you'll write 10 times better than you ever did before. Think of the maturity you'll be bringing to your writing."
"My head aches too much just now," I said.
"It'll stop aching soon," he said. "It isn't broken, and it's filled with a heartbreakingly clear understanding of the self and the world."
I said.
"And I'm going to be a better painter for the change, too," he said. "I've never seen the tropics before. That brutal glut of color, that visible, audible heat."
"What's this about the tropics?" I said.
"I thought that's where we'd go," he said. "That's where Rezi wants to go, too."
"You're coming, too," I said.
"Do you mind?" he said.
"People have certainly been active while I slept," I said.
"Was that wrong of us?" said Kraft. "Did we plan anything that would be bad for you?"
"George," I said, "why should you throw in your lot with us? Why should you come down into this cellar with the black beetles, too? You have no enemies. Stay with us, George, and you'll deserve every enemy I have." He put his hand on my shoulder, looked deep into my eyes.
"Howard," he said, "when my wife died, I had no allegiance to anything on earth. I, too, was a meaningless fragment of a nation of two. And then I discovered something I had never known before. What a true friend was," he said. "I throw my lot in with you gladly, friend. Nothing else interests me. Nothing else attracts me in the least. With your permission, my paints and I would like nothing better than to go with you wherever fate takes you next. This is friendship indeed," I said. "I hope so," he said.